This is CliffCentral.com. Auto Central, powered by Auto Trader on CliffCentral.com.
All right, folks, good morning. Welcome to Auto Central, brought to you by Auto Trader, your trusted motoring marketplace. And I think we'll just get straight into it. Not such a full studio today. George, how are you doing?
Hey, good, and you, Tom?
Yeah, good, thank you. Martin, how's it?
How's it, Tom? Nice to be here again.
Yeah, good to have you here. Were you here, you were here 2 weeks ago?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was just very late.
Oh, yeah, because you sat in that crazy traffic.
Yeah.
Anyway, all good.
None of that today, though.
No, I must say, but some of the schools go back tomorrow, I think. Mm. So it means it's all going to get chaos.
So 2 weeks' time, I'm probably going to be complaining again.
We'll be moaning about the traffic. Exactly. Everyone have a good weekend?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Right, let's get straight into it. I think some good news for consumers and motorists in general is that SANRAL will not pursue the e-toll debt. So the South African National Roads Agency has announced that it is suspending the process of pursuing e-toll debt. According to a statement from SANRAL spokesperson Vusi Mona, it resolved that given the initiative led by President Cyril Ramaphosa to address the e-toll payment impasse, SANRAL will, with immediate effect, suspend the process of pursuing e-toll debt. This includes historic debt and summonses applied for from 2015. No new summonses will be applied for. What do you guys take? What are your thoughts on that? I think it's fantastic for motorists. I think for one thing and one thing only in my universe is that the consumers actually won. I think the guys, you know, put their foot down. They said they're not going to pay these things. There was a whole hoo-ha about it.
I think everybody lost.
At the end of the day, absolutely.
Everyone lost.
Because the country takes a knock, right?
We took a knock for those stupid gantries.
I agree.
Yeah, those things should never have been erected in the first place.
They've become one massive white elephant. What are they going to be used for now?
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of copper and precious metals in there.
Scrap metals aren't worth the flipping cost of erecting that thing.
Well, maybe it can improve some cable thieves' life. not encouraging anything.
Just saying. #Just saying.
No, I mean, I think this should have happened even before those things were erected. So it's a good thing, yeah. but still, everyone's lost.
Do you think this kind of stuff before it goes out should be put to kind of public vote?
You can't have that because that's why we vote governments into power.
Mm.
You know, in order to take that burden off us.
Yeah.
You know, so otherwise we should just vote.
On everything,
all the time.
Yeah.
You know, we're just going to spend our lives voting and not working.
We'll spend our lives waiting in queues.
Yes. I mean, most, like, you know, that's a waste of time if you ask me. But this shouldn't have happened in the first place.
So I mean, ultimately, you know, the taxpayer paid for these to get erected.
We're still paying for it. So you think you're not paying e-tolls? You still are.
Yeah. Well, it's just funny that this comes down and then, you know, other things go up.
Yeah, this came out of somewhere. It came out of the consumer's pocket. That's where it came from.
Absolutely.
So these big fancy gantries that you see on the highways, it came out of the consumer's pocket via tax.
But like I said, they should never have been there in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, look, this is the result of possibly some agendas being pushed, as well as a complete lack of consultation with the public.
But that's where I was going to with it.
For myself,
maybe there should be a threshold. You want to spend X amount, you got to get a public vote. You know.
Yes.
You know.
And also,
like there's a threshold to how much you can spend.
Also, I have a problem in principle with this particular implementation because, like 60%, I think, of all the revenue generated by the system would have gone outside our country's borders in any case.
Well, if they could collect 60% of the revenue.
But even if they could collect it, 60% would have left the country. Sure. Yeah. And that's a bad idea for any economy.
I think so too. So
let's all rejoice.
Well, I mean, Wayne Divenocher, he's from Outer, said that this is indeed good news, but not the end of e-tolls yet. Until the decision to declare Gauteng freeways as tolled road is
revoked.
Yeah. Mm. So SANRAL's decision is only a suspension of chasing debt. We want more clarity from government on this issue for now. The signals, the end is near. So we'll wait and see what happens. But that maybe could have worked if the money was, you know, if you knew what the money was going to be put towards and wasn't, you know, lining anyone's pockets and the money wasn't going overseas, it could have been something that could have helped us.
And indirect contravention of the National Credit Act as well.
Really?
Yep. If you did not sign up for an e-tag You did not agree to their terms and conditions.
Correct.
Which means it's in any case completely unlawful to keep you responsible for that, that debt, because you did not sign up for that debt.
Yeah. Which means that's obviously why they can't chase the debt.
Exactly.
You're not liable to pay it then.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So obviously, clearly, you know, this is obviously done not in consultation with, you know.
Comes back to a complete lack of public consultation and possibly, like I said, agendas being pushed.
Anyway. All right. So we'll move on from that. And some other good news, and I think this is, you know, we'll get onto it now. But anyway, motorists urged to snitch on fellow road users who violate traffic rules. So the city of Johannesburg has launched a WhatsApp-based hotline which enables motorists to report traffic violations committed by other road users. The hotline, which was launched on Wednesday, will be operated by the Johannesburg Metro Police Department and will enable people to send photos and videos of illegal activities they're witnessing to the hotline. So long story short, there is a WhatsApp hotline, and I want to give you that number. It's 081-410-6338. And if you do see someone driving like a Muppet, you can take the photograph of the guy, make sure you get his license plate or get the video of him doing whatever he's doing. Then you need to tell them on this WhatsApp line who you are, where the incident occurred, and you need to leave your contact details so that they can get back to you. They say that your details will remain anonymous. You know, I think it's a great initiative. It's a fantastic concept. But again,
how
are they going to enforce this, and how is it going to be policed?
Look, photos alone probably won't do very much.
No.
Probably won't help very much. But videos of moving violations, I think that's a great idea. And I wonder why it took them so long to come up with this initiative.
Well, listen, I mean, I think from, you know, just having, you know, read the whole article and stuff, I know people do sometimes send stuff into the Metro to, you know, to complain and bitch and moan about whether stuff gets done about it or not. I think that for me, like, awesome. But what is the point of getting the information in if it's not going to be used? Or, and we continuously speak about visible policing.
Well, the thing is, this is a good opportunity for JMPD to make some money, so I believe they will actually use this.
I hope so. George, what do you think?
It comes down to what you said just now, the ability to actually execute on the violations, you know. So there's no point. I mean, look at what happened the other day. People shooting firearms, you know, discharging firearms at a intersection with two police officers standing right there. You know, like, either they don't want to do anything about it, or they're too scared, or they don't have the resource.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all nice, you know, and I think in theory it's good. And it may work for a lot of incidents.
Yeah.
Are they resourced enough to be able to handle the flood
of stuff that's going to come into their
WhatsApp?
I agree.
You know, you're going to get, and now somebody has to sit and actually sift through the stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
So you're going to have a team of people. Mm-hmm. There we go. You got to pay another like
four or five salaries
in order to monitor what they've created. Yeah.
Yeah.
So from a business point of view, that's a cost.
Right? Yeah.
Then they have to kind of report that to, because somebody has to sift through the junk.
Yes.
Because someone's going to have a road rage incident and somebody's, you know, changing lanes and they don't think it's law abiding.
Yes.
And they're going to take a photograph and now you know, empowering people to take photographs while they're driving.
Well, so this is the thing, right? Yeah. So these guys have said that you've got to be very careful with how you go about this. They don't want to encourage the fact that you, but if you're in your car and you're sitting in traffic and someone comes past you,
it happens in the moment.
It does happen in the moment.
So is this going to be able to be policed?
Well,
executed, all that stuff? No, it remains to be seen.
Well,
it's good in theory.
I think it is good in theory.
In theory,
I think people should invest in dash cams then.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Because a dash cam will have a timestamp, and some of the fancy ones will even give you the GPS.
Well, that's quality material.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. But the vast majority of people in South Africa don't have
dash cams. Yeah.
So you're going to find people hanging out the window with a phone trying to drive.
Hey, you know what's going to happen? It's going to be like a chain reaction. So some oak's going to come down into oncoming traffic, and this oak's going to have his phone out the window, and then the lady behind him is going to go, look, he's driving with his phone, and she's going to take her phone out, and the person behind that person is going to see that person. It's just going to continue in the traffic.
I love this. We should create an ad.
Exactly, we should. You know, or just people driving around in Johannesburg with their phones out, ready to just, you know, snap anything that goes down or that's wrong. But anyway, look, I think it's a good thing, and you know, let's give these guys the benefit
of the
doubt.
It's a nice theory. We'll see. Let's see if it actually works.
All right, we'll see that. So let me just give you that number again. It's 081-410-6338.
Sorry, this thing is going to have a lot of content.
Lots and lots of content they're going to have. You'll probably see a lot of kind of clips and videos that will come out of that, you know. They're going to get some proper material.
Yeah.
Well, let's see if it ends up on social media. They should actually, you know what, the JMPD should actually start like a content channel. With all this stuff coming in, can you imagine the awesome or the crazy footage that you would get of Muppets on the Road?
Yeah.
It would be like, be able to watch like a station.
Start encouraging people.
I'm actually going to go mad, man. Anyway, so I suppose a good thing to not such a good thing, a whopping increase in fuel prices on Wednesday, and that's not an April Fool's joke today, I promise. The price of 95 octane unleaded petrol and lead replacement petrol increased by 1.31 rand in Gauteng.
Hell.
And 1.26 rand a litre at the coast on Wednesday. 93 is going up 1.34 rand and also 1.29 rand. And diesel's going up 81 cents a litre. And paraffin by 63 cents a litre. So that's not, that's quite a whack. I wonder if it's got anything to do with the fact that they're not chasing ETOL debt and they're going to get it back from us through increasing the petrol price.
That and taxes. Remember, extra taxes were announced at the beginning of the year, the budget speech, and this is the effect now.
Yep, exactly. So, not good news. So, I do encourage everybody to fill up today or tomorrow.
I did yesterday, and I parked my car in the garage.
And just left it there with a tank of petrol in it. Nice.
It's probably doubled the car's value now.
Like, so you put in the landy?
Yes.
Oh, okay. There we go.
What did it cost you to drive from the garage home?
Probably half a tank. Yeah. I didn't look.
Anyway, who should or shouldn't you allow to drive your vehicle? So from a family car to the company truck, there are some important things to know about liability involved in loaning a vehicle. So, I mean, if we just paint a scenario here, I borrow your car and I take it for a drive and I have an accident. You are liable because you the insured driver.
Culpability goes to the person, you know, in control of that vehicle in terms of, you know, what happened.
What happened, yes.
So if you're talking specifically about insurance, well, that's important.
Correct.
You know, so culpability and insurance are two different things.
Yeah.
You know, my car, if it's not insured for you to drive,
correct,
then the cost of fixing my car is going to be on my shoulders and my insurance is not going to pay for it.
Yes.
Okay. That's the first thing. But the culpability of who's responsible for the Ferrari you crash into is yours.
Yes.
It's not mine.
Yeah.
I wasn't in control of the car. Yes. No. My insurance won't pay for my car.
Yeah.
Doesn't change the culpability, in my opinion.
Talking about crashing into Ferrari, I actually heard the craziest story about 2 weeks ago, and what you said there just triggered us. I'm going to tell the story quickly. Friends of friends of friends, whatever, two young oaks driving in a, I don't know what it was, like a Hyundai Accent or something, just a regular, you know, 9-to-5 car, drove into the back of a guy's Ferrari.
Probably texting.
What they were doing. But they shouldn't, yeah, exactly. They were watching all the hot stuff coming in. Anyway, drove into the back of this Ferrari, and this Ferrari guy got out, and he was one of those Burley Oaks gold chain tattoos and stuff. And these two lighties thought, oh gosh, here we go.
Here comes trouble.
And he turned around, he looked at both of them, he looked at the front of the car, and he said, how much damage do you think, sir? And they were like, we don't know. He opened up his boot and he paid them 15,000 rand and he drove off.
He possibly had something that he didn't want to be discovered.
This is the thing. So don't phone the police. He has 15 grand. Away you go.
Make
China.
It go
Thanks
away.
Very much. How's that?
Someone who carries 15,000 rand in cash with him.
Can you imagine those two oaks going home? Oh, we drove into the back of Ferrari and he paid us 15 grand. Happy days. Hey, they scored.
Your car's broken, but it's going to cost 5 grand to fix. Woo,
scored 10, exactly. I know, crazy. So anyway, sorry, we get just that popped into my head. But so talking about, you know, who can and who can't drive your vehicle?
As far as private vehicles go, the insurance companies generally do allow a little bit of leeway regarding authorized drivers, as long as this authorized driver is not behind the wheel or the primary driver of the car.
Yes.
But this also depends. The car has to be fully roadworthy In other words, even after the accident, if they find smoothish tires, yes, the claim will be refuted. And if the driver does have
insurance companies are license, looking for reasons yes, not to exactly. pay. I mean, they're yeah. always looking for reasons
exactly.
not to pay.
Exactly. So make sure the car's licensed and fully roadworthy and that this driver has a valid license.
Yeah. My point is, I don't think it only goes down to other people driving your car. You know, even if you have an accident, the insurance company is going to look for a reason not to pay you. Mm.
Undisclosed modifications is another one.
Yeah. So,
oh, really?
So all of that applies. Doesn't matter who drives the car. But if your car specifically, some insurance companies, they have a different excess. If you're not driving the car.
Yes. Yeah. So this is the thing. Is also, and that excess will go up. I mean, if you lend the car to a minor or something, you know, like a younger driver, then your excess is going to go higher because, I don't know.
Yeah. Kids drive. Well, higher risk.
Whereas higher risk. Mm. Yeah. So just be careful about who you do and who you don't lend your car to.
Best advice, find out from your insurance broker.
What the policy
or insurance
is.
Yeah. company, what your policy stipulates. Yeah.
And if somebody else is going to lend your car, I mean, you just need to send your insurance company an email just to say, because then you've got written proof that, you know, communication was sent about that, you know, someone lending your car. But I think to your point, just make sure that you know.
Yeah, but a contract is two-way street, eh? So you can send an email, but they've got to acknowledge that the car is covered.
That, okay.
And what the conditions are on the contract.
Yeah. Cool. So, yes. I don't know. I mean, I don't have issues with people driving my car. But I'm not going to lend it just to any old body. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I don't think the insurance company cares who it is. No. It's like, if it's not covered by your contract, it's not covered by your contract prevention clause.
Exactly. Anyway, so George, this I actually thought this was quite interesting. So fighting an electric vehicle fire is still a new and dangerous concept. And if you think about it, it really is, because there are not a lot of people who would have experienced this.
Well, I mean, there's an orange cable in all electric vehicles.
Well, I learned that this weekend.
This orange cable is a and the reason it's orange, no other wire in the car is orange, is a sign of high voltage.
Yeah.
Over 60 volts, which can electrocute you. So the problem isn't the fire. Or the potential fire. The problem is electrocution. I mean, we're going to get onto the Grand Prix later on. Mm. But one of the Renaults that amazingly stopped at the same time as the other Renault, for a while that car, you saw the light flashing on it. The car was still alive, which means that if anybody touches that car, they could have got electrocuted.
Jeez luck.
You know, because of the electric system within that Formula One car, and all you need to do is touch the car and be earthed. That's it.
And you'll know all about it.
There's not even about touching the orange wire. If that orange wire somehow is damaged and is touching the car's body, and you as a firefighter come and you touch the car and you're earthed,
you're going to know all about it.
You're going to know.
Especially if you spray water over it.
Yes.
Well, this is the thing. So when an electric car catches fire, you can't treat it like an internal combustion engine car. You need a lot more water, and you can't store that car afterwards in a similar matter either. What they do is they take these cars and they put them into an area that's got like a 15-meter radius, because, I mean, there was a Model S Tesla that they tested, and it caught fire twice because obviously there's obviously stuff that's going down in that battery.
Well, there's energy that's in the other thing.
Yeah.
Lithium ion batteries, as the name says, has a fairly high concentration of lithium, and the problem with lithium is it reacts with oxygen. So as soon as it gets exposed to the air, it starts an exothermic reaction, and that leads to the thing catching fire.
You've been reading up on electric cars.
No, I know my chemistry. I aced it in the trick.
I thought he was researching electric cars to give me a go.
So you have to isolate the lithium from the air. All right. So if the battery pack on one of these electric cars with lithium ion or lithium gel battery packs get a battery rupture of some description, the little flame that starts will quickly grow into a larger flame, which will strip away the other insulation and just expose more of the battery to the air, which brings us to this story about the BMW. What? Yeah. So there's another story about the BMW that had to be submerged for a day or 2 days.
Jeez luck.
Submerged in water.
just to make sure that it was
and to let the thing cool down to the point where they can actually get to the batteries to isolate the lithium from the air.
But it's crazy. Like, I mean, you know, my head doesn't go like a go. You know, we talk about electric cars and electric cars, fantastic, but you don't understand the repercussions down the line. Like, you know, when these cars are in accidents and stuff like that happens, you know, firemen need training on how to now deal with a completely different animal, right? Yeah. It's a different kind of fire.
But you don't get things like explosions, though.
Yes,
you know, so for instance, so you know, people mustn't think that, oh, it's an electric car, it's 10 times more dangerous. No, it's not.
No,
It's just different dangers.
Different dangers.
It's just different. And we just need to learn to deal with them. Yeah. I mean, you think about a flipping ice car. You're sitting on a 60-liter bomb.
Mm.
You know, when that goes off, it's not going to go off slowly.
No.
It's going to go off quickly.
Yes.
You know, the fuel's going to burn fast. So, the same risks are there. It's just different.
Different. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got shocked the other day. I touched the electric fence. I was working in the garden. Ish. I wasn't even thinking. I had a ball of string. You should see how far that string went.
Never a great idea.
Did it knock you?
Proper, both hands.
Were you like out for a second?
I was properly rattled.
There's a bit of a 50-hertz Macarena there.
Yes, yeah, trying to punch another. 50-hertz Macarena. Indeed, I did. I did. Actually, then I stopped and I checked. Like, I was going, hang on a second. Yeah. Am I still breathing? My tickers are out.
Yeah, but the fact that you're actually thinking that.
No, anyway, it scared me.
It's a bit of a shock to the system.
Again, I'm touching the freaking fence. There's this one little bush that's falling over, so I wanted to tie it
to the electric fence.
To the wall, to the wall. But there's electric fence, obviously. And the electric fence didn't even come into my head. And as I put both hands up to get the string around the top of the fence, fucking thing nicked me properly.
Did you properly touch it?
I proper touched it, like almost like both across like all my knuckles.
So you know, do you know why those electric fences pulsate the way they do?
Mm-mm.
To give you a chance to let go. Because electricity causes your muscles to contract.
Yeah.
Not, you know, so as soon as you get an electric shock, your muscles will tense.
Yes.
Involuntary. So
involuntarily tense, and you can't get them to loosen up. Yeah. So that's why those energizers pulse like that.
Sure,
is to give the person a chance to let go. Otherwise, I mean, you can put a constant electric current through the electric fence, which will be the same thing.
Yes, but you just...
But you'll get someone touching that fence and they will
die. It's crazy. I promise they'd ball a string when it's like throwing a streamer.
So there's our pro tip for the day. Don't touch an electric fence. Don't touch the orange cable in an electric car.
Because it would feel like touching an electric fence. Load shedding. I mean, we've obviously been going through this for a while now. It seems to have died down a little bit in the last couple of weeks. But what if there's no power to charge my car? SA Motors remains skeptical about electric vehicles. And there was a poll done on Wheels 24 about... we asked readers if they would buy an electric car in South Africa. They got 14,000 votes. 38% of the respondents said, what if there's no power to charge it? So that's clearly a big issue. It is a concern.
Yeah.
It's definitely a concern if you've got an electric car. And, you know, and the load shedding, I mean, we experienced it. It was like off from 6 in the morning until 10 o'clock and then, you know, in the evenings as well, you know. And we experienced it at the work as well. So what do you do? I mean...
You invest in a 15 kVA generator.
15 kVA? I've got a 10 kVA in my house.
And you still got to go buy
But can it can't charge a car? That,
well, slowly.
It's very slowly.
You can't use a fast charger with that.
Yeah.
I mean, your car will be on the charger 0.4, like 10 hours or so.
So anyway, so 38% of voters said, what if there's no power? 29% maybe if EVs were affordable. 20% said, no, I'm a petrol head. Martin was one of those oaks. And then 14% said, yes, it's the future. So just interesting to see that. And that takes care of that. Wow.
So out of interest, what voltage is what voltage when you get shocked can you feel? Up to what voltage?
Well, I don't know. What is going through that electric fence? Because I felt that.
Oh, no, that's a couple of thousand volts.
Yeah, it's got me.
Very low current.
Yeah. So the chances of killing you are low.
Low.
But in order for you to feel a shock, most of the time the voltage needs to be under 100 volts.
Okay.
So for instance, you won't feel a 24 volt battery shock you.
Yeah. Those are little square jobs.
24. That's not 24.
Which is that little square 12, battery? If you stick 12. It on your tongue, you can feel it.
It was a nine volt battery. But that you can only because of the saliva.
Yeah.
But generally probably under 100 volts, and you won't feel it as much as over 100 volts, 110, 120 volts, 240 volts. You're gonna feel it.
Oh yes. What do you feel?
Yeah, no. Well,
so you know, 50 volts, it's gonna give you a tingle, but it's not gonna affect the human body too much.
It's crazy. Yeah. Anyway, listen, what happened this weekend? F1. Let's chat about it because
holy cow,
the electrics broke.
Yeah, exactly.
On the Renaults.
You've got these electrical problems.
I was waiting all night to say this.
Someone cut the orange wire. Eh? So George, give us
imagine this bomb disposal unit. What's this orange wire on this car?
Yeah. Give us a rundown. What happened in the in the Grand Prix?
So Leclerc, I don't know whether to pronounce his name Charles or I don't know what it is.
Probably but, Charles, being French.
Hails from Monaco, and some people call it Monaco. Who knows? But he drove a brilliant race. Now, I mean, I support Ferrari no matter who the driver is.
Correct.
I've done that for the last 15 years.
Yep.
No matter who the driver is, the number one driver in Ferrari is the one I support. And, before we get into the actual race itself, the disappointing thing is that Vettel seems to have continued his lack of restraint and his lack of focus into this year, which is really sad because he's a bloody good driver.
Yeah.
He's a really, really good driver, and the problem is he lets his emotion get the better of him, and in any situation, emotion's a good thing, but yes, you've got to be able to channel it right in order to get the best results. So a highly emotionally charged individual can actually perform better than a non-emotional person because you can channel that energy in the right way, which is really hard to do. Hamilton does that well.
Yes.
Now we don't know what's going on inside of Leclerc. I mean, you can't tell me that there aren't any butterflies or flipping hippopotamuses doing flick flacks inside him. It's his first flipping, works team driver with the top team in the world.
Yeah.
and he kept his head about him the entire weekend. He got onto pole.
He was on pole, right?
Yeah. Got onto pole. Outraced Vettel on Saturday by at least 0.2 of a second, and which is big in Formula One.
Yeah.
Got onto pole. Vettel was obviously second. The Ferraris are better than the McLaren seems to be.
Yeah.
From a car standpoint, and it looks like this problem that Leclerc suffered was maybe what they were trying to protect from in the first race, and maybe they let the car go in this race in order to see what it's capable of, and they hit this this issue with Leclerc. Don't know, speculation still. But for the first time in the Bahrain Grand Prix, there were 3 DRS detection zones. There's always been 2. There's 3 DRS detection zones. There was a crap load of overtaking, which was probably one of the best races I've seen in a year or two.
Yeah.
There was a lot of high wind at the start of the race. A massive tailwind down the finishing straight, which caused the drivers to and probably one of the reasons that Vettel spun was because of a crosswind. These cars they are aerodynamic because of their high speeds.
Yes,
but naturally they create aerodynamic forces. So if you think about an airplane is sucked up into the air.
Yeah.
With these cars, they use the same aerodynamic forces. They just the car's just forced into the ground.
Yeah.
And as soon as you change the direction of the wind, you're going to change the aerodynamic forces on this car.
Yeah.
And when Vettel spun out, he spun out on lap. Which lap was it again? 38. Mm-hmm. He spun out on lap 38, and then flat spotted his tires. And because he spun out on lap 38, flat-spotted his tires, there was massive amounts of vibration, and his wing fell off, and he drove straight over it. Had to go into the pits and change tyres. So there's lots of wind on the start. Vettel managed to get into the front on the start. He passed Leclerc. And I think the reason he passed Leclerc is because he's been driving Ferrari so long. He knows that car. Oh, he knows the starts. He's a much more experienced driver than Leclerc. And Leclerc battled to get going to Vettel's benefit, and then there was a slow puncture on one of the Red Bulls, and so at lap 9 the Red Bulls started to pit, which then caused a pit frenzy. And it's funny how one team pits and everyone else thinks like, oh shit, something's going on. Better flipping pits. Yeah. You know, what's their strategy? Yeah. And then suddenly all these fireflies come into the pits. So what happened was Mercedes-Benz tried to pit and do the undercut on Vettel. The undercut is you pit first. If you're behind another driver, you pit first, or even in your front, you can do the undercut. You pit first with the hope that when you come out, you're on fresh tires, you can do a faster lap.
Okay.
And when the other person goes to pit, you pass them.
Okay.
So that's the undercut.
Yeah.
And Hamilton got the undercut right.
Okay.
He pitted, did a really good pit stop, came onto fresh red-walled soft tires. Went out, Vettel's tires had already been deteriorating, did faster out lap and next lap. Vettel came in the very next lap, changed tires to the yellow-walled medium tires. But the yellow-walled medium tires are slightly harder than the soft tires, which means they take a little bit longer to get hot.
Yeah.
And in that pit stop, Vettel did a really good pit stop, 2.4 seconds, I think. Hamilton passed him in the pit change. So Hamilton got ahead of him, and then Hamilton's tires started playing games. Though he just couldn't get to the right temperatures for those red-walled soft tires, and couldn't get them to perform the way they should perform. And as a result, with the car that's probably slightly slower than the Ferraris right now, Vettel started catching him. But that didn't last very long, and then when the next pit stop round came about, they put him on yellow-walled soft tires, yellow-walled medium tires, and Hamilton managed to end up ahead of Vettel. When he passed him, that's when Vettel spun out in lap 38, and then I think Vettel ended up on fifth. And then Leclerc had his electrical problem. Towards the end, and even Hamilton right at the end said to Leclerc, you should have won
on
this.
That race, yeah.
You should have won. So it was sad.
First podium for him, huh?
First podium for him, yes. First pole position. So Leclerc, I think you've got to watch this guy.
Lots to come from him.
Yeah, he did a fantastic job to limit his drop from the lead to third.
To be honest with you, in the Ferrari team, my loyalty might be shifting from Vettel to
mine
Leclerc.
Too.
Yeah.
Okay, and what happened to the Renaults? I mean, you know, if you had said to me both Renaults retired,
someone pushed a button.
Yeah,
someone in the control room in the pits pushed the wrong button.
What is this button? Push it.
Yeah, jeez,
so because they both fell out on the same lap in the same corner with the same problem.
That's the French for you, though. It's not going any further. Stuff you.
Insert obligatory
yes.
cliche joke about French electrics.
You do that accent well, Tom.
So they both just, what did they do? They stopped.
And that brought out the safety car, which means that there was no overtaking, which means that Leclerc's
podium
third place
was
saved.
Saved, yeah. He wouldn't have been on the podium had it not been.
Because Max was catching him. I looked at the live timing results as it happened.
Yeah. No, Max would have passed him.
Max was closing that gap.
I think it was like half a second a lap or something. More. It was more than half a second a lap.
Well, I mean, he finished, 300th of a second behind him?
He would have passed him on one of those laps.
Yep.
Really?
Yeah, because the rules under safety car conditions.
Yes, you're not allowed to overtake.
Well, there's a maximum speed imposed.
Okay.
So you're not allowed to overtake.
Yeah.
And then there's a maximum speed. So call it 80 k's an hour. And most of these cars can go around that track at full ball, 80 k's an hour, no problem.
Yes.
So as soon as the safety car comes out, everyone slows down to 80, whatever the speed limit is. I don't know what it is right now. So nobody's going to really drive slower than 80 k's an hour. So the gap stays the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can't really catch a person in front of you.
I don't think anyone's ever been as happy to see the Renaults retiring as Leclerc was. But still, I mean,
why would that have affected Leclerc?
Well, if they didn't go out, the safety car wouldn't have come out, and then Verstappen would have passed him.
I get you.
Like a lap and a half to go.
Yeah.
All right. So that sounded like quite an exciting Grand Prix.
Look, I don't actually follow Grand Prix very much. I'm not that active a follower. Mm. I mean, what George told me now was very informative, because now I know what happened in the race yesterday. But when I saw what was happening with Leclerc's over results and lap times and everything else, I just had to start following this. And then I started seeing the timing.
This year's going to be much better than
last
year.
Well, we hope so. I hope it's not a runaway again.
No, it won't be. I don't think so. I don't think it's going to be a runaway for Mercedes. I don't think it's going to be a runaway for Ferrari. You can see that.
Yeah.
It's just not the case this year.
So all Ferrari needs to do is to get that electric boost reliable. That last 160 kilowatts.
Yep.
Just get that reliable, and they might actually have a very good shot.
The car without that MGUH, which is the harvester that harvests electrical energy from the turbo and the system to recharge the batteries, because that went wrong in Leclerc's car. Without that running in this race, the car was only operating on its ICE engine.
Yep. Okay, sure.
That's all.
Yeah.
So it wasn't using the battery. And you can see how much that electrical system power actually gives.
Well, I read somewhere last night that's 160 kilowatts gone right there.
160 horses.
Or 160 horses.
Sure.
Could be. Anyway, still a lot.
Anyway, listen, I see F1 veteran Alonso tests Toyota Dakar Hilux Buckies in South Africa. So Toyota Gazoo Racing driver Fernando Alonso completed a two-day evaluation test at the wheel of the Dakar Rally-winning Toyota Hilux in South Africa from the 17th to the 28th of March, which is quite cool.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know he was here.
I saw some photographs.
I saw some photos of him.
Yeah.
He was obviously driving with Janiel De Villiers.
I saw the photographs.
Yeah, and he's Fernando's mentor through the test. But that's quite lucky that he was here. I didn't see that. Just a bit of information there. And then
I think Janiel probably scared the living daylights out of him.
Probably.
Because I've been in that buggy with Janiel.
Oh, have you?
Yes.
No, that's completely different.
That's like everything's turned up to 15 instead of up to 10.
Yeah. Jeez. No, it's mad. I was fortunate enough once to go around Juratek on the off-road course there in a souped-up 90 Defender.
Right.
And
the things these people do with their cars.
Was absolutely crazy. And then I see Sebastian Vettel believes Mick Schumacher fully deserves his first chance to test a Formula One car. Did he test? He was driving.
No. So I actually totally slipped my mind to say this, but there were two. I watched the F2 this weekend because of this.
Yes.
There were two things that was a first this weekend. The first one was Mick Schumacher. Racing,
yep.
So it was his first drive in F2, and he was to the front of the midfield in like position 8, I think it was, under massive amounts of pressure. But the second thing in F2, first time ever, Tatiana Calderon, drove in the F2. So I thought that was quite special. So I watched the F2.
That's a big change in motor racing history, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and how did she go?
It's her first race. Bear in mind, I think it's tough for her. So she was in the back of the field.
Okay.
But I think it's a good learning curve for her, and it's a good thing for the sport.
Absolutely. I think I'm no expert, but I can imagine her being obviously extremely nervous, being the first female driver in, an F2.
Mm.
And but the butcher is, as soon as she becomes comfortable and goes, hang on a sec, you know what, I've actually got this, I think we might see some really, really different things.
Yeah.
Which is cool. So I think
it's very cool. Hats off to her, and, well done to F2 for letting this happen.
I think it's really good, and then her and Lewis can go and buy diamond earrings together and paint their nails and all that shit. Anyway, buying a car in the digital era. this is what has changed. George, you wrote a really, really nice article on your blog just about how much digital has changed the car buying journey. And what's happening with, you know, consumers and the decisions they make and the time that they spend. And I know that this, obviously, there's a lot of information in here that would pertain to dealerships and stuff like that, but I don't know if there's anything here that you really wanted to touch on in particular. Just know that it is changing. So 95% of consumers are buying a car using digital as a source for information. So twice as many start their research online versus at a dealer.
Well, I think the overarching thing here is us as consumers, the nice thing about sitting in front of your phone or tablet or laptop is that you're anonymous.
Yes.
You can interact when you want to interact. And I think a lot of the business world misses this point. This very, very important point.
Yeah.
Is the consumer wants to remain anonymous until the consumer doesn't want to be anonymous anymore.
Correct.
Okay, so now you've got to ask yourself the question, when is that?
When that person's ready, probably ready to make a decision.
When is that in the car buying journey? Probably it could be freaking anywhere.
Well, you're right. Yeah.
It could be at any point in time.
Yes.
So the car buying journey, what we've learned so far, is not linear.
Yes.
It's not a process that goes from X to Y or A to Z.
Yeah.
So consumers will go through the car buying journey is not difficult to establish. Mm. It's what is the behavior within the car buying journey that's important.
Yeah.
And it's been proven through a lot of our research and international research that the consumer vacillates between different places in the car buying journey, going forward, going backwards, going into the real world, then coming back onto the internet and searching and comparing. And so this journey is not linear. If you think of a ball of string, that's what the car buying journey looks like.
Yeah.
Ball of string. Okay. You can't follow it very easily.
Yes.
But the touch points are still there, mm-hmm. but you don't know where the consumer is at any point in time. So the anonymity is what creates the conundrum. When is the car buyer actually ready to engage with the seller?
Yeah.
It's hard to establish.
Yeah.
Okay. So in saying all of that and the anonymity, as a seller, whether it be you be a private seller or whether you be a dealer seller, the best thing you could do is put yourself in that car buying journey's path.
Yes.
At as many moments as possible.
So try and make yourself accessible
in
as many of those touch points as you can, because you don't know when the consumer is going to make that decision
that
to go
choice to
I'm actually going to phone now, or I'm going to walk in now, or I'm going to email you now,
go to this guy instead of the other guy.
And it's about influence.
Absolutely.
So at the end of the day, what you want to do is you want to influence someone that you can't touch, can't feel, can't put your hands on, because you don't know who they are.
Correct.
So you got to influence them.
Yep.
So understanding your particular journey to your particular car that you have for sale is probably one of the most important things. Is I mainly operate in a particular demographic. I want to sell my car to this particular type of buyer. What type of behaviors do they typically display? And then use influence to get them down that car buying journey.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's, it's easy to understand, but it's also hard to understand because you've now got to obviously make yourself available in so many more touch points.
Exactly. And it's difficult because most sellers, most retailers of cars, they think about the journey in a linear fashion, which means, oh no, I'll just slap up an ad and I'll put a form in front of somebody and they will fill it in and I will get a lead and I will sell a car. No.
Not going to happen like that. No,
because
the consumer has changed as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
So understanding that journey and then creating different pieces of marketing to get the influence to get that consumer influence to pick you.
Well,
is the most important thing.
I mean, to a point in your article, most people are only spending 15 seconds looking at a vehicle, which means you've got
not looking at the vehicle on a page. Yes.
So you've got
whether that be a vehicle or
whatever.
Not,
so you've got 15 seconds to try and influence that person. So make sure that you've got all the necessary bells and whistles and information that consumer
count
wants.
To 15, and that's your influence opportunity gone.
It's like practicing an elevator pitch if you think about
it. Yes.
Yeah. It's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Your message has got to be clear to the point and relevant to that point in the car buying journey. So you can't use the same messages in different places in the car buying journey.
Yeah.
Use different messages in different places.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? I think what's important also is that 60 to 70% of consumers are searching on their mobile phone.
Yeah.
So if you as a car seller are not squarely focused on the influence on that little screen, and you know, most businesses today, if you think about it, a business people sitting in front of a laptop, they will go and they will look at stuff on a big screen like this.
Yes.
Oh no, that looks pretty cool. I think that, you know, this has opportunity to influence. But then you go and you figure out that experience on this mobile phone, and it's a totally different story.
Yeah.
So rather put your messages forth on a mobile device than try and try and assess something on a desktop or laptop. Mobile first.
Cool, George. Thanks very much. Well, gents, listen, we're all sitting here. This is actually a massive, massive, massive week in the motoring calendar of South Africa, because lo and behold, we've got the Auto Trader South African Car of the Year final awards happening on Thursday night.
Yes.
On Thursday night. And what's really, really nice to know, and the reason why I talk about it quickly, is it's been a phenomenal competition. It's been really nice to be involved in the Car of the Year competition as title sponsors. I think there's been a lot that's changed. We know that there's been some big developments over the last couple of weeks and months. And what's really nice is that, you know, it isn't by invitation only, because it is an exclusive event, but we will be streaming it live.
That's the exciting part.
So on our YouTube channel, for the first time ever,
The longest standing, most prestigious car award in South Africa will be streamed live on YouTube.
Absolutely. Giving access to the consumers out there, and showing them what the Car of the Year Awards is all about.
We're massively, massively excited about this, because you know, it's the first time ever.
So it's a great idea as well to have it streamed live, because remember, right at the outset, we involved the public as well. So the public vote actually. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So now those same people who actually participated early in the process can actually see the outcome.
100%.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that will be on our YouTube channel. So if you log on to anyone, if you just follow our social pages over the next couple of days, we will be putting comms out about how, when, why, and who. But that is on Thursday night, and I could probably safely say that from about 7 o'clock ish, you should be able to tune in, probably earlier, but
we're probably going to put the link up a bit earlier.
Yeah, the link
day
will be up earlier.
Doesn't mean anything's going to be happening on it until we start.
Correct.
But the link will be there. You can kind of get ready, get your popcorn.
Exactly, and I can tell you now, it's going to be a show not to be missed. Really is going to be spectacular.
For some reason, I'm expecting a surprise or two as well.
I think there are going to be some surprises here. We're not quite sure. I mean, that must be one of the most closely guarded secrets.
I think there's only like 4 or 5 people that know.
Yeah. And probably stay that way until Thursday night.
Yeah.
Which is the intention. So fantastic. Yeah, so tune in, please, guys. You know, log in and watch the Car of the Year. It's the first time in the history of the competition that this is ever going to happen. So that's really, really exciting. A little bit of a change. I know that we went out and we were going to do our review this morning on the BMW 8 Series and the Z4, which was on launch. And Lawrence was fortunate enough there to drive both of those vehicles. But with him flying to China, they moved his appointment with the embassy. Yeah. So our
going
review for
to China,
today.
China.
He's going to China, my China. So if you want to
see your review,
read the article. So the article is on autotrader.co.za under our news and review section, and Lawrence has actually got a really, really nice article there. But I just thought, you know, Mark, you here, you've also been driving cars. You were in the Subaru,
WRX.
The WRX.
Yes, and so it felt like a homecoming to me. I've always loved this specific generation of WRX.
Yeah.
And this, the one I drove, was an example of the recently updated version.
Is that the one with the big fat exhaust?
It has 4 big fat exhausts sticking out the back. And that's the first sign of intent. And if you look at it from the front, there's the obligatory Subaru bonnet scoop as well.
Okay.
And you know, side skirts and big wheels.
The nice thing about the Subaru, I can't stand the way the Subaru, the aesthetics on the outside. I just think it's ugly. that's just my opinion. But
you're not completely wrong.
The thing about the Subaru, all Subarus, is that flat engine sound.
Which this doesn't have anymore.
Why?
Because it's a new generation engine.
when this,
so they took the thing that appeals to me.
They took it away.
They took it away.
But there's compensation because this new engine really is a thing of beauty.
Is it not a? Is not a?
It's still a flat four.
Flat four.
It's still a flat four. But
then how come the noise is gone?
All right. So the earlier EJ engines, the ones that went which you like so much, they had a different exhaust design. So the turbo was located in a different spot, and that led to unequal length pipes. Subaru Oaks will know what I'm talking about. Unequal length headers, and there's a big debate about equal length versus unequal length headers. So the moment you go for equal length exhaust pipes from the flat four
efficiency.
You score on efficiency and heat dissipation and all sorts of other things, but that sound goes away.
That's why. That's why in the old days you got this is the reason banana branches exist.
Yes.
Anybody remember banana branches?
No.
Yes.
No. Enlighten me, please.
So I had a 325 Shadowline BMW.
Ooh, and those things worked so well.
And and I put banana branches on my Shadowline.
What
now,
is a banana?
So it looks like a bunch of bananas.
Bananas. Because what they're trying to achieve is they're trying to get the exhaust pipe out of each outlet to be exactly the same length.
Yes.
So no. So you imagine, you know, these things were straight six engines.
Oh, so a banana branch.
So you've got a straight six engine, six cylinders in a row. Yes. That's what straight six means.
Yep.
You've got a straight six engine. And, you know, so the distance between this particular piston now.
The front one and the back one.
The front one and the back one to the exhaust at the back is a different length.
Okay.
So now, so what you've got to do is you've got to measure this, the front one nearest the grill's length. And you got to make the back one the exact same length. So you got to wind it to get down. Yeah, called
well, banana branch. That's a nice explanation, George.
Thank you very much.
So, yeah, effectively what Subaru did was give this new engine a banana branch.
Okay.
Now, just in case you're worried, you can still get the STI with the old type engine, which still goes for not too much more money. It's like 60,000 rand extra.
Hmm.
So there you go. You can still get your traditional Subaru noise. However, this specific test car had the new engine, and it's a lovely thing. Lots of torque, low down in the rev range, nice free revving power characteristics, and it actually, you can sense that there's a lot of power. There's only one problem, and it's my usual bugbear with modern Subarus. This one had a CVT, a constantly variable transmission, as the automatic option.
Which is a lot of clutches.
No, it's not the most clutches. It's a torque converter and basically a couple of pulleys to determine your gear ratio.
A lot of clutches. Because the torque converter is effectively a clutch.
Effectively a clutch, but there's only one of them. So what this means is there's this disconnect, this non-linearity
So the torque converter, just to kind of like, I don't know if Ty knows this.
No, I don't.
The torque converter, your scooter?
Yes.
Has... what is almost like a...
Well, that's probably a centrifugal clutch, which is a different thing altogether.
Okay, explain.
So a torque converter is a hydraulic coupling between the engine and the transmission. So when it stands still, when the car is at a standstill, but the engine's running, the hydraulic fluid in the torque converter allows the one side to turn and the other one to stand still.
Yes.
But as you increase the engine speed, the hydraulic pressure inside the torque converter picks up.
Yep.
And that's when it starts transferring power.
Similar concept though, right?
Similar concept.
Except that one has liquid and that one is
normal
mechanical.
Friction lining.
So it's normal. Okay. So as the engine spins, so your centrifugal clutch will hook onto each other.
Yeah.
And less power, and they'll be apart.
Okay. Now I can see time's completely lost.
In both instances, it's still a clutch.
Effectively, it does the same thing.
It does the same thing.
But the CVT, okay, that's another kettle of fish. Completely. There are no actual gears inside a CVT. So you have a drive belt with two pulleys of varying sizes.
Yeah.
Electronically controlled. But that means that you don't get that sense of direct connection you'd get with a normal gear, because this thing changes gear ratios all the time.
Yeah.
And unfortunately...
so there's no immediate power. There's some efficiency loss.
That's the thing. And a WRX to me is supposed to be an involving thing. So you touch the steering wheel and it must dart in another direction. And you touch the brakes and it must stop. Mm. And you touch the accelerator and there must be a difference to the way the power... to the power that actually goes through to the wheels. And this one just doesn't do that.
So the moral of the story
Buy it with a manual gearbox.
No, buy it with an electric engine.
No. Well,
because now they've taken the noise away. What is the point, honestly? They've taken the sound away. They've like totally, you know, this is like you remember the old Beatles?
Yes.
Like you love the old Compton.
Well, that was my first car.
That noise?
Yes.
Okay, flat four.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons that noise exists. Is the old Beetle and then the exhaust system.
Do you realize that we're probably going to end up with a lynch mob of Subaru fans outside the Auto Trader offices in about half an hour?
Well, in their WRXs, really.
There's probably about 50% of them that are like peed off with this car because it doesn't have that sound.
And the other 50% with the old 2 liters are probably broken.
Exactly. So no, that flat four sound, I mean, even the Porsche has a flat engine.
This new WRX introduces their EyeSight driver assistance technology, which actually works very well. If it sees a pedestrian, for instance, running in front of the car, it will automatically brake. And if it sees something coming from, or you approaching something in reverse, and it warns you and you don't heed that warning, it would slow down as well.
Oh, wow.
So it's all sorts of accident or collision mitigation and avoidance technologies with lane keeping assistance and traffic jam assistance and so on. So that, again, that works very well. And it handles the way a WRX should.
Okay. So let me just point out, the sound's not there anymore.
The sound's not there. But the chassis is beautiful. It's very luxuriously equipped. No, George, you cannot have it with an electric yet.
So if you want to take the sound away, might as well put an electric engine.
Let's disagree there. Anyway, the article, the review is live on site already.
Fantastic.
So you can go read all about it and why I actually called it a split personality in a sedan body.
Okay.
It does suffer from a bit of let's call it an identity crisis, but it's an endearing car in its own right.
Fantastic. Price?
That's where the problem comes in. R631,000 and, well, and listen carefully, and 400 rand.
Can buy a Tesla Model 3.
Not in South Africa, because they're not here. However, you can almost buy a Golf R for that money, and unfortunately, the Golf R will drive right over it.
Really?
Yeah. Okay, it's not as well equipped, but and it's not as nice to drive, but you get a lot of kit and a lot of straight-line performance extra with the Golf. So this Subaru, I'd say buy one by all means, but buy it with a manual for about 30,000 rand less.
30,000 less.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay, cool, Mark. Well, thanks very much for that. Talking about that technology that you're talking about, I see Nissan and NTT Docomo have revealed that they are in-field testing the automaker's invisible-to-visible technology. So that's called R2V. First unveiled January 2019 at the CES trade show in Las Vegas in the US. And RTV technology seeks to merge the real and virtual world. So essentially, what the car in the future will let you do is it will tell you what's coming up around the corner before you've even got to there. So this car will see anything that happens.
I mean, that's that has to be based on technology that means cars and objects communicate with each other. So it has to be based on that technology. And I see that being quite far away because, you know, while cars are today the things that of more futuristic, like electric cars and the systems that are in them, where we seem to, you know, not be as far ahead is in the infrastructure. Yeah. So
I also see you need 5G
to do it. You know why? Because 5G, there's no latency.
Okay, so it's instant.
It's instantaneous. So you can imagine in a scenario with a moving chunk of metal.
Yes.
If you have any latency, there could be an accident.
Correct.
So there has to be immediate communication. So that's the reason the 5G exists. But I think what was more interesting for me was this and more doable was this Hyundai's keyless entry.
I know, that looked really, really nice.
Really interesting. There's Hyundai introducing the smartphone based digital key for new cars, which is kind of like, you know, they're following Tesla. I mean, let's be honest.
Hang on, that's not all that new because Tesla does it. That's what I just said. And Volvo has it available on some of their cars as well.
You know, has it available isn't like doing it.
Well, they do it in Europe.
Fair enough.
But they use again same story. NFC.
No, absolutely. But it's nice. It's nice to see that it's coming to a you know, Volvos are pricey cars. They're not cheap cars. Teslas are pricey cars. They're not cheap. Whereas I'm not saying Hyundai is a cheap car, but you see more of them. There are more of them sold in South African roads. So it's nice to see this technology coming into kind of you know, everyday cars. Well done, Hyundai. I think
it's really nice. I mean, just walk up, literally tap your phone on the, or bring your phone close enough to the handle, and the car will open. And you can, and I can let you drive my car by sending, by telling you to download the app or giving you a code.
Or sending you a code,
Correct, And what's nice as well is I can limit how far you go and how long you get to
and
drive.
How fast
you can switch a car from remotely.
So you won't be able to steal my car when you're older. Okay. You won't be able
to.
Be in big trouble. Guys, I think that's us. Another show. Fantastic. Thank you very much. George and Martin, I hope you guys have a fantastic week.
Fun show. Thank you very much.
Our YouTube channel on Thursday night, and come and watch the first AutoTrader South African Car of the Year. And we have a very, very special in-studio guest. Happens to be my son. He's turning 8. Happy birthday, bugger. I love you.
This is CliffCentral.com.